Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. This is your trigger warning. This podcast is raw. It is real, and it doesn't sugarcoat what it means to survive trauma, abuse, mental health battles, or even the aftermath of living in survival mode for too damn long. What you hear on Survival Mode Disrupted includes unfiltered stories, graphic details, and a vulnerable truth that may trigger some of the audience. Please prioritize your emotional safety. If something feels too heavy, pause. Breathe. Come back when you're ready or not at all. Your healing is yours to honor. These episodes are based on lived experience, not therapy sessions or clinical advice. Listening does not replace mental health treatment or constitute a coach-client relationship. If you're in crisis, please seek immediate help from a licensed professional or contact your local emergency services. This space is built with care, but it's also built for truth and built for disruption. Take what you need, leave the rest, and most of all, trust yourself. If this podcast speaks to your soul, you don't have to do this work alone. Feel free to join our free Facebook community for high-achieving women ready to break cycles and heal out loud. Join us at Disrupting Survival Mode on Facebook. Or grab the book that started this movement, Exiting Survival Mode, a raw step-by-step guide to help you identify, release, and rebuild from the survival patterns that have been keeping you stuck. Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. We are now wrapping up the week of Bermudian Stories, and I'm super excited to have Franco with us today. So Franco, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is Franco Harris. I'm a 41-year-old Bermudian. I've been living in the UK for 18 years now, and I'm kind of wrapping up that journey. I'm entering into the final year of my doctorate at Oxford at the moment.
Amazing.
But I've been home. Thank you.
Amazing, amazing. So what is your thesis on, if you don't mind me asking?
So the nerdy title, the title of it is The Socio-Spatial Dynamics of Gang Violence in Bermuda. So it is based in criminology. It's a doctorate in criminology, but I'm studying the gang violence issue from a very island-focused lens. So how do the dimensions of smallness and isolation, and how does a small island community come to terms with the issue? And what are the kind of issues and factors that make it very difficult to respond to as opposed to larger, more cosmopolitan areas like the UK or US?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a definite need for what is going on the island right now, just to explore that. I did see an article about you recently, and you were talking about, you know, the different avenues that we need to take in order to tackle the gang violence in Bermuda. So I hope to dig into that a bit later, but let's start at the beginning. How would you describe Survival Mode?
The interesting thing, I was reflecting on this, survival, I felt like I was in survival for so long, and I felt like survival was my life. And, you know, I grew up in what you call the hood, back of town in Bermuda. Both of my parents were addicts. I was a short, little, awkward boy growing up in the hood. So It was just a very natural state for me. I didn't really know that I was in survival mode until maybe like my teenage years, where things were a little bit more visceral and dramatic. But yeah, survival mode for me was just like a regular state of life. I didn't really realize that that's what I was in until I kind of, yeah, and until like the real physical elements of abuse in many different forms within my own hu home, within the community and whatnot, that really made it feel even more present. But you know, surviving to get food, surviving to kind of get love, whatever it was, just felt like a normal state for me. I didn't know any different, any better.
And I think on reflection as well, like most of us do not know. Like I wrote my memoir probably a year and a half ago. I'm yet to still publish it, but it wasn't until I finished writing it that I recognized that I had been in survival mode for decades. And it was just like this aha moment. And one of the reasons why I started this podcast is because I don't think that we talk openly enough about the residual impacts of trauma, how it shows up in our lives, and what it takes to move beyond that. Because, like you said, it tends to be the norm for a lot of us. So now I'm curious about your story to and through survival mode. I do like to highlight from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah, so first of all, again, like what I was talking about, I grew up in the hood. My parents were both addicts. I didn't know that at the time. I'm just a young boy trying to navigate the world and those dynamics. But everyone kind of knew I was gay before I did, you know what I mean? And these kind of like calling me all types of names. And you know, it was like really pick a struggle. I was poor, I was black, I was short, I was intelligent and nerdy, I suppose. I wanted to hang out with the girls. I wanted to hang out with my mom. So it, you know, I got packed lunches at school, which automatically made me kind of like, oh, you're a poor person and all of that. So it really was like pick a struggle, you know what I mean? And so I had to kind of like always be on fight or flight. And then at home, you know, I lived in a very abusive, physically abusive home. My father, you know, bless him, I've done a lot of healing and a lot of work now, but you know, he was just really physically abusive to me and to my mom. And I didn't really understand back then as well, but my mom was psychologically abusive. So it was a different element. Through her pain and through her frustration, I was living the world through her eyes, because my father was the big bad wolf because he was physically violent to me. My mom, again, I didn't really know. She was just talking all sorts of things to me that probably I shouldn't have been hearing as a young child, but it was through her pain, right? And of course, a young boy who's so close to her mom, seeing her crying and going through all these changes, it was only later that I realized through my own healing journey, the part that my mom also played in particularly like my mental health challenges and whatnot. So yeah, like navigating that was really hard. I didn't feel safe in my home. I didn't feel safe in my Bermudian community. And yeah, on a small island like Bermuda, you know, that was really visceral. Like I couldn't speak to my dad in a way and get the support from a father like a son should. So yeah, I navigated a lot of that. And then that kind of just continued, you know what I mean? It got worse. My father and mother separated. I went to the other end of the island, the western end, which is Dockyard, a completely different vibe, but another hood. You know, I'm living in a house, I believe it was eight people in a 1.5 bedroom house. So my father's girlfriend had children, and then my father had kids with her. So I describe it as Cinderfella. You know, like I was in that house, I hated it. I really wasn't being taken care of. There was a lot of kind of psychological and physical abuse there, horrific from my father again and my stepbrothers and whatnot. And so I navigated that. And you know, I was a young boy. I must have been about 7 or 8 years old. And I just remember walking down the street with no shoes on, blistering hot sun. And I just felt like my feet were cooking, right? But it was like a form of self-harm and taking me out of my body, because I think my father had just slapped me or something and told me go outside, and he used to make me show my physical abuse to other people, like just to know that I had got slapped up. Like he'd be like, go out of the house. And so I was walking down the road and I was praying. I just like looked up to the sky and I was just like, I need help. Get me out of here. And something came in my spirit to call my aunt. I'm one of my Christian aunts in the family. And she was like the well-to-do aunt and the bougie one that everybody gave side eyes in the family, but she was really lovely. And I explained to her, I said, Auntie, I'm really scared. This is what is happening at home. And she was like, Frank, I can hear her voice now in the most calm voice. She just said, pack a pair of socks and underwear in your bag every day or whatever, and we will pick you up on Friday. I'm from Victor Scott from primary school. And that's what happened. And she took me to her house. And she called my father on the phone, and she's because my father's named Frankie, and she was just like, big Frank, I have little Frank, and I love you. I'm not judging you, but we're gonna take care of Franco now for a while. You get yourself together. And I was so scared, because I was like, my dad's gonna come, he's gonna beat you up, he's gonna beat me up, all of this. And of course, it didn't happen like that. He had a profound respect for her. And again, as a little child, I didn't really understand that he was human as well. It's like, you're my dad. But he was so violent that I just thought that's all he was. I didn't see him as an addict. I didn't know that he was vulnerable as well. So anyway, I went lived with her for a while. And then I'm becoming a teenager now. You know what I mean? I'm coming into puberty. I'm coming into a real sharper understanding of the world and my place in it, and getting more angry, actually. Coming into real terms with my sexuality and being in a really Christian household and all of these dynamics. So now I'm starting to buck against that and kind of be like, you're not my mom, you're not my dad. I'm tired of church. I don't want to be here. And so I moved out when my dad got out of rehab, thinking that it was drugs were just the be all and end all and the problem. So now he's sober, so he's going to be fixed. And that wasn't the case. It was my last year of high school. And I was really kind of like starting to go out and, as a teenager, certain going to the club, and Bermuda's so small. I'm not knowing that I'm bumping into people that my father knows. And anyway, so like he beat me again really badly in Barclay, kicked me like across the floor like a soccer ball, really. I mean, I was screaming. And then I had to go to school in my winter uniform to cover up all the welts and the like marks on my arm. And then of course my teacher was like, you're out of school uniform, Franco. And I just broke down. Like I was really this kind of popular, a little bit rude, saucy type of boy at school. But like that moment I just broke down. I couldn't hold it together anymore. And then of course, for safeguarding, my school was like, we have to call the police and da da da. And then imagine a black boy, black family. I'm now kind of, because I had a younger brother and sister, I felt like it was too late for me. I felt like the damage was already done. But suddenly I realized, like, oh, I don't want this to happen to them. Right. So I pursued it through court. Well, it was out of my hands, really. But like, basically, to still go through that process, then I'm got like my aunts like calling me, like, don't, how could you do that to your dad? And this and that, and da da da. And so that was quite traumatic, you know what I mean? But I still saw it through. And then I even wrote a letter to the judge and I was like, look, I don't want my dad to go to jail. I just want him to know that he can't do this anymore and the effects that it's having on me. So we got through that. And then, but then addiction came in, drugs and alcohol to kind of soothe and numb my feelings. And I got wrapped up in that for a while. And it just kind of progressed. I left Bermuda at 16, went to New York City. I was homeless in New York. I was there during 9/11, but I was happy. I was happy to be homeless in New York rather than being in Bermuda and subject to everything that I was going through there. I mean, horrific violence. Like I would have to wait at night because back then, this is when we had crews and posses that used to hang on the block or in certain areas. And I live in the hood, so I would have to wait until dark time so that I can like just kind of run across the street or hide in the trees so that I can get home safely without being attacked or somebody throwing a bottle at me or whatever. So navigating all of that and then going to New York and also never been there before in my life, 16 years old, navigating that. And that was really hard and tough as well. So this has always been these cycles. After that, I ended up coming back to Bermuda. My addiction led me to go to prison, basically, in Bermuda. That was just wild. I was like one of the only visible gay guys in Bermuda at the time, particularly coming from the hood. So when I went up to prison, they were like monkeys on the bars, like, what? Batiman, Franco, da da da. Everybody like making all this noise. And everybody who was my enemy or a bully was there. It was like my worst nightmare, right? And so I fought for my life and I fought for respect. And in twisted ways, I got that in the end. Like I got some respect because I had to lose my mind, like an animal. Like you never know what you're capable of until you're put in these situations. Like I just thought about all the abuse that I suffered from my father and just like growing up. And I was like, yeah, I just lost my mind. Like I will fight you back and I will go to the lengths that I have to go to. And that followed me wherever I went. And so, I got out of prison. Went back to prison and to do with drugs. And my mom died when I was in prison overseas in Canada. And I lost my mind again. And because I was so close to her and she had been ill for a really long time. And now I couldn't go back to be with her and be there for the funeral. So I came back to Bermuda. I was doing more drugs, lost my mind. And I said, if I don't get off this island, I'm going to harm myself or somebody else or go back to prison. So I moved to the UK. And that was, again, another journey. I went to law school. I went, got my pre-law degree. Then I transferred to University of East London because where I was in Buckingham, I was like, this is boring. It's all cows and green pasture. I wanted to go back to the city. And my addiction and my mental health took over. So I dropped out of law school and I started DJing and kind of lost myself for about 6, 7 years. And my mental health took a real dip. And then eventually I got clean. I started to change my life around that. I'm 9 years clean now. So I'll be 10 years clean and sober from drugs and alcohol next May. But yeah, from that moment, I kind of got myself together, but I almost died. I OD'd. I never told my family. I was just like nearly on my deathbed in the hospital for about 3 weeks, scraping the bottom of my lungs because I did all types of drugs. And again, I was just like numb. You know what I mean? I just felt like I made my bed so I can lie in it. This is just a story of my life. I felt really despondent, really broken. And yeah, so that, and just also still also navigating the space now in the UK. And this is what's really interesting. Since I got clean and sober and came back into my body, I realized like, okay, I left Bermuda hating Bermuda viscerally and not understanding that the battlefield was in the mind as well. So Bermuda had a place in contributing to my pain and just like my harm, the way that the harm that was inflicted upon me. But actually, a lot of it was in my mind and the lifestyle that I was living and the decisions that I were making, some based on trauma, some just based on like pure bad decision making, et cetera. And so when I got clean, I started to realize it's like there was just this weird feeling. I was like, I don't belong here in the UK. I felt like a minority. And people would ask me, where are you mixed? What do you mix with? And I'm like, I'm black. Like, and it just because I'm a light skinned. So it was all these dynamics that actually I didn't kind of have those issues in Bermuda. And I felt like other in the UK. So I felt like I wanted to go back home. And that's kind of why I started to fake point my research to Bermuda. And now I'm slowly on that path to come back because I did the healing within and I still realize the way that my community is kind of like still needs work and still quite harmful in many ways. But now I feel like I've gone through all of that. The pain becomes purpose, right? So I'm kind of using my story and using my lived experiences to kind of like help my community and shine lights on different issues through my lived experience.
Franco, I told you before we started recording that I saw a clip of your story, and then I've sat here in awe as you've told it, not in its fullness, but the abbreviated version. And one thing that you said that really stood out is like when we get to a place in our healing journey where we can actually reflect on our purpose, it kind of leads us back down that road, right? Like, as someone too who has been in the UK for a while and probably am now seeking something more familiar, something that feels a little bit more like home, I understand why there would have been a need to leave as well. Because as someone who experienced a lot of trauma in Bermuda, what tends to be true is that we can't always heal in the same places that we've been hurt. And maybe removing ourselves, and obviously you probably experience a lot more out here in the UK, but sometimes we have to remove ourselves, even for a temporary time, just to do that reprogramming that you talked about. And I love that you mentioned that, because whenever I talk about accident survival mode, I say it happens in three phases. The first is a self-awareness. A lot of times we're operating in a space where we just don't even know where we are. And I often liken self-awareness to like Gibbs Hill Lighthouse, right? Like this beam of hope and inspiration that can give us the opportunity to change path, not to get shipwrecked. But a lot of times we end up shipwrecked because we don't have that level of self-awareness. The second step is reprogramming. We have to challenge the narratives that we hold. We have to challenge the beliefs that we hold. We have to also learn how to forgive ourselves. Like you spoke about your, like the decisions that you made that probably amplified the addiction, amplified what that looked like for you, because like you're kind of just stuck in your head. You talked about like, okay, I moved to the UK, but then it was this realization that a lot of the stuff that was going on, it was what was going on within. And until we are able to challenge these narratives, challenge our thoughts, we just repeat the same patterns and habits, because everything's recycled. And then the last phase is a reinvention, which you spoke to as well. Like now you're doing more that will allow you to assimilate back to the environment that, you know, you've grown beyond, but are ready to get back embedded in that. I don't know if it may just be a cultural thing. There's something very homely about Bermuda and the way that we were raised and our culture. Very friendly people, but the other, on the flip side of that, very friendly but very closed-minded. So unless you have like really solid footing in your identity, it's easy to get lost.
Yeah, absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head for everything. You know, even me coming home, I've been home here for my research for a year. And I always knew theoretically in my mind that this was going to be a real test, right? Of me, what it would look like moving back home permanently. But nothing could have prepared me for the actual reality, right? So the first 3 months, I had actually like symptoms of like PTSD, right? Where my mind, because the people, places, and things that were trigger points for me when I was living in Bermuda, I kind of had a whole Rolodex. It was quite ever present, right? So if I looked at somebody, I would know a certain guy, oh, okay, I'll walk across the street, or I have to attack you before you attack me in the club, because that's like a protection of mine or whatever. And or like, so when I came back, it was like, oh wow, like I've been away for so long that I forgot. Like people are aging. I'm like walking, and I'll walk across somebody, and I would be like, my nervous system is just so dysregulated, right? Like I don't know if I have to defend myself. I don't know if I should run. I don't. And so like, yeah, like I ran into therapy here, you know, and it's been the best thing to kind of guide me out of that. And it's been a slow process, but like, you're absolutely right, right? It took me having to remove myself out of the belly of the beast, out of the scene of the crime, so to say, for me to kind of like get the healing that I needed, right? And that was amazing. I had to make no apologies for that. And I suggest anybody to do that, particularly because it's any small community, right? It's but like in Bermuda, it's just pervasive because you're in the middle of the Atlantic, and you is no way out if you don't have the money or the means to do so, right? So yeah, getting out. But then the interesting part is, like, I only healed to a certain point. Like, there was a threshold in the UK. So I've been in recovery for a while, and that has touched on the three stages that you're talking about. That is what recovery is about. It's really about looking squarely at myself, really letting go of all the judgment and all of that, and then reinventing myself. But like I said, it was only able to go to a certain point in the UK. I was like, ooh, I have to go back to the source to get that last level of healing, to kind of really show up, to kind of assert myself in a new way, to be vulnerable, to access that power through vulnerability in my own community. I can't do that away. So I had to face my family. I had to face all of it. And what's been so interesting is, again, in my mind, I was prepared for war. I was prepared for all manner of different kind of adverse experiences, and it has not been that. I have been met with nothing but love and respect, and oh, it makes me emotional just thinking about it, because it's sad that I had to go through all of that. And what therapy has helped me to do is pick up all those broken pieces, and I'm still in the process of doing that. But what I needed the most was to actually have Bermudians. One guy came up to me. He said, "Hey, I know you don't remember me, right? But I was coming out of the gym," and he said, "I was really, like, nasty to you in high school. And gosh, it was just," and he said, "I apologize, you know." And it's little things like that. To me, I saw another guy in the store. I know him for a fact. He's like, "What up, fam?" And I'm like, "Fam, you know, like, you were like a menace to me back in." But I appreciate it. I receive it. I open myself up to the conversations with different pastors and different people who hold different views than me. I'm able to kind of say, like, I hold space for your differences. I'm not trying to change the way you think or your beliefs, but I just want you to see how you have harmed me. Or maybe if it's not you specifically, but your ideology, but all of that I needed to do without being so on a defense, like, really just calmly, plainly being seen, being heard. I'm going back to Oxford next week, a completely different man. My first year of Oxford, I was checked out. I didn't even have the space within me to kind of want to do the Oxford experience and really be a part of the academic community. I was like, get me in, get me out. I ain't here. I don't really care. I'm grateful to be here, but no. Now I'm like, actually, I can show up. I feel so much better about myself. I can go back to the UK and, God willing, wrap up this last year and a bit in a much better place, just be much more open to kind of, like, the experience of even being out there. So I needed to kind of come back home and face those demons and interact with those shadow elements of myself that I tried to run away from, you know?
You raise an interesting point because some people think that the absence of triggers is healing, but it's not. We often run away from the things that we know will escalate our emotions or put us in a bad state. I think the next level of healing is just what you spoke about, facing those demons, being able to be triggered and but learn how to work through that, being able to take the tools that you might have learned earlier in your healing journey, or they highlight exactly what you need to work on further. So I do get that. Like, I think for me, even on my journey, I spent a lot of time avoiding the difficult conversations because I didn't want the spiral to happen emotionally, right? I had learned to control my emotions along my healing journey, and I didn't necessarily want to disrupt that because I knew what the opposite of having control of my emotions looked like for me. But I wasn't able to test my healing in that silo, in that vacuum that I created for myself. And when I started having conversations, when I started being honest and telling people how my experience with them made them feel almost asking for accountability in some aspects, right? It was received in a different way because I had already worked on my healing. And like you say, like time goes by, people kind of move on and maybe even reflect on their actions. So what would have been done maybe 13, 15 years ago, it's definitely met differently. And then I also, the difference is that is you've laughed, you've done things to make massive improvements in your life. And as we both know, it's almost like we're in a fish tank once we are Bermudian, right? We're always under observation by somebody, right? So, but we don't have to shout the healing. It shows up in our actions. And also in that separation, I think it gives us an opportunity to fully step into all our authenticity. And Bermudians listening to this may not necessarily know what I mean. I feel like we don't get to be ourselves in Bermuda, especially growing up, we're kind of conditioned to be a certain way that is acceptable by others. And being able to leave and come back, that space of leaving and being able to find ourselves and step into our authenticity unapologetically, and then come back, the energy that we exude is completely different, right? Because we're now not looking for that external validation. We're now not looking for, we don't need approval. We don't need someone to co-sign who we know we are, but it takes work and it takes time. But I think it's always rewarding when we can get to a place where we reach back to help someone else. And I always say this on this podcast, I think that's actually what self-actualization is. Like, I know you probably learned about that probably in primary school, like the pyramid, you know, like, oh, you gotta get love, you gotta get shelter, you gotta get food. And then eventually you get to this space of self-actualization. And I don't think I actually recognized what that was until I really anchored into my healing and then got to a place where, although it was hard and tough, there was a level of gratitude for what I went through because I wouldn't be who I am today. The woman who is so passionate about these type of conversations and helping people move through their trauma, had I not gone through my own, and it really taken me down to my knees in order for me to build myself back up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. You know, it's never nice going through it, but I'm very grateful for the journey and like the ability to be able to pour into people. It gives me an empathy, it gives me an understanding, it gives me a worldview that, and I see it. It's a huge kind of responsibility, but a beautiful responsibility and weight. It's just, you know, like it's one guy like just homeless in town, and you know, I take him into the store to get him food or whatever, but just how I'm like authentic, I mean, like really handling him like a human being, like seeing past, because I'm like, I've been there, you know what I mean? In different forms that maybe didn't look like that. But again, all of these things, it's just that full circle. And we talk about it in recovery. It's we give away but has been freely given to us. So all of that love and that care and that understanding, we are able to then give it away. And that is like the story of my life. And that is why how I study what I study is not just like academic-y kind of, no, they are participatory methods. They are methods of engaging with people in my community and centering my lived experience rather than kind of just seeing myself as this so-called academic. No, it really is about centering my experience because I'll be bored without anything else. Like I really want to be able to pour into other people and, you know, so yeah.
You spoke about this both when you spoke about your mom and your dad, and if there was this level of compassion, like on reflection, right? Like you recognize that when you went through those things, like you really didn't understand what was going on, but like you even said, like I didn't even understand that they were addicts, like you know, but To get to that level of compassion is key, because like we're all fighting our own demons, we're all dealing with our own levels of trauma, and some are not as compounded or as complex as others, but we're all trying to figure it all out in some way. And I just think if we spent a little time just in consideration of what somebody else might be dealing with, I think it just brings us back to a level of empathy, compassion, and consideration that is so needed on this world. Like, it shouldn't take us being able to walk in someone else's shoes to be kind or be compassionate, right? Like, and one of the things that I've always struggled with in within our community is our ability to ignore what's going on until it hits our front step. It's a problem for all of us. Trauma is a problem for all of us. Addiction's a problem for all of us. The gang violence is a problem for all of us. And we all have a level of responsibility, whether or not we accept it or not, to try to find a solution, to try to work towards a solution collectively. And I think compared to where Bermuda was when I left and probably when you laugh, I do think that they have made big strides in the level of closed-mindedness or the level of ability to talk about difficult conversations. But I still think that there's a long way to go, because there's still this separation of whether it impacts me and I care, or it doesn't impact me and I'm not sure if I should care.
And in a roundabout way, that is this at the center of my research, these dynamics, right? Because naturally, in a small community, and the combination of our history and colonialism, and like particularly Black families and the pride of kind of like not embarrassing your family, not bringing your family into disrepute, what goes on in this house stays in this house. All of these things were really like protections, right? Words like anxiety and depression were privileges of white people in my mind. Like we never even used those type of words until recently, so it was really harmful because like we were just told to get on with it and to because that's what our ancestors and our grands and our greats done. But in actual fact, that getting on with it was just suppressing and avoiding and adding and compounding and passing on that intergenerational trauma and passing it down. So the thing about healing is like, I'm not responsible for the trauma that was inflicted onto me, but I am responsible for my healing. And that sometimes that annoyed me that in the beginning, because the weight of that, like I was just like, well, hold on. I was a child for a lot of this stuff. And like, surely I did not deserve that. But because this is like a point that everybody asks me about, because I said, I've never hated anybody more than I've hated my father, right? And now I struggle to find someone that I love more than my father, right? Because we've both done the work and we continue to do the work. But it was a moment where I came to my father one night. He was working in a rehab place and I banged on the door. I was high on cocaine, actually. This is the first night I snorted cocaine. And I was just full of emotion. Like I didn't know how to kind of deal with it. My anger boiled over, right? And I just sat him down and I was like, don't you talk. I want to talk. And I just vomited out everything. You beat me. The blood was coming off of me. You made me all this stuff. And I'll never forget the most genuine look in his eyes where he was just like, son, this is not an excuse. What you're saying, the things that you're saying are horrible. He's like, but I'm telling you the truth. I remember nothing of what you're saying. I was an addict. I had my issues, and I'm sorry you went. And I just remember it almost felt like those cartoons, like my whole head exploded, right? Because I was like, what do I do with that? Like, I can genuinely see that he's being honest. And so that day, I'll never forget it. It was just a supernatural conversation between God and I in my spirit as I was high. Like, because it was like, you have a choice, Franco. Are you going to wear your pain like a shawl, like a jacket, like a heavy coat. Now, for the rest of your life, you're carrying this rage and this anger and this frustration. And he doesn't even remember. What are you going to do about that? And I felt like I grew up that day instantly. But it was interesting because it's one of the favorite things that I've said to my father. I said, look, Dad, right there in that moment, I forgave him wholeheartedly, 100%, because I realized what it was doing to me, right? I realized how poisonous that resentment and that bitterness, what it was doing to me. But what I said is, I forgive you, but I will not forget, right? We will not forget. So that is what has been part of our healing, is not forgetting, being intentional about that. So finding those moments with love and with gentleness to talk about that stuff, even if you don't remember it. And then also holding space for him to kind of speak about. And it was funny because my therapist in rehab, I remember her asking me, so she said, how old are you? I told her my age. And she said, so like, how old was your father when he had you? And I was thinking, you kind of do trying to do the math. And then like, I can't remember how old, but basically he was young, right? And I was like, so she was like, now, could you imagine having you at that age? And it sounds so simple, but in my head, again, I just never thought of it like that, right? And I was like, it is no way that I would have been able to kind of continue on like my life having a child, you know? So like, yeah, when I saw like had that understanding, I was like, oh my God, I finally humanized him, right? I was like, me with a child in my 20. Now that's not an excuse, right? Like for his behavior. And this is the delicate thing. I always tell people, anger is healthy, but when you're consumed by that type of anger where it's a burning kind of like rage and whatnot, there's no value in that. That doesn't do nothing. If I can put that in my recycling plant and make that anger work for me, meaning it propels me into my healing and to go into seek therapy and to go into work through that trauma and stuff, then it has use. But if I'm just allowing it to poison me, like that has no value, right? So, and I understand that that's different for different people. So yeah, like I just think that is how what helped me to forgive my parents. But there's a process for that. You know, it's not like, oh, it just suddenly I kind of forgive and forget. No, I think it is really important and valuable to hold space for our feelings and those frustrations and stuff. But it was important for me to heal in order to forgive them, you know?
Absolutely. And I'm a person who is resistant to forgiveness in this space because it's often, let me not say always, it's often pushed prior to the self-work, right? I had to be able to forgive myself for the decisions that I made. I had to be able to forgive myself for the action that I didn't take, all of that, before I start handing out forgiveness to everyone else. And as you know, we've been raised in a very religious driven culture where, I think we have more church per capita than anywhere else in the world. And so God is embedded in the way that we show up. Whether we're religious or not, whether or not we went to church on Sundays, or we were ones that were at church on Wednesdays too, right? But I often see in this space that people push forgiveness of others, and without recognizing how detrimental it can be to the person who hasn't yet healed, who hasn't yet been seen and understood, because a huge part of that healing process is getting to a place where you feel seen and accepted. And even if it comes from one person, whether it's your therapist or whoever you're working with, that's so key. And oftentimes we don't see ourselves, right? So you saying, I had to work on my healing first before I can forgive others, I think is something that we often overlook. So thank you for saying that. Well, Franco, I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I usually end these episodes asking people, how can we connect with you online? But I would love to learn a little bit more, if you don't mind, about what you think is necessary for Bermuda to move to a space where we can collectively heal from our trauma.
Yeah, thank you. Funny enough, like in initiatives like this are is what is needed in part because it starts with each and every single one of us, right? So first of all, like working on our own healing and finding spaces where we can heal, we can speak authentically, we can be held with love and gentleness, no matter what we have going on, right? So first of all, finding that place, because it's very much tied with what you just shared, right? I cannot really pour into you or my community unless my cup is full. Everything that pours over is for other people in my community. So I think some people also in line with what you just said as well, like have good intentions, right? But they're pouring from an empty cup, or they're trying to. And that is also in a way to kind of avoid what is going on for them by kind of like focusing on somebody else and this savior complex kind of thing, when the person that needs to be saved first is themselves, right? So in order for us to really truly engage with each other as a community, to galvanize around kind of issues like gang violence or whatever may be plaguing our community, we do really have to take care of ourselves first, right? And then we're able to kind of like come together. So I really am keen about cultivating spaces like this of authentic communication, that raw, real kind of space where vulnerability is seen as power rather than as weakness, and actually showing like that turning that pain into purpose. So it's that kind of stuff where we're all dealing with something, right? Pain is relative. You don't have to have the kind of like large scale kind of trauma or different abuse and different things that, like, say, I've gone through, but everybody is dealing with something, right? And I just think it's about, yeah, being able to find spaces to kind of like do the work that is needed individually before we can show up collectively.
I love that. I love that indeed. Well, first, before we wrap it all up, I want to celebrate your 9 years clean. I've been in relationships with two addicts, and I understand how difficult that journey can be one day at a time, like for real, for real. So I celebrate you with that, but I also just want to thank you again for your time showing up to share your story. So thank you. And audience, thank you for catching another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. I just want to remind you, you were not built to break, but you damn sure were not built to just survive. Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. And I'll see you next week. Once again, thank you for joining another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted, hosted by the Survival Mode Disruptor, Letitia. You didn't land here by accident. This conversation, it probably cracks something open on purpose, because survival mode isn't just a phase, it's a pattern, an identity, a prison masked as strength. But here's the truth: you're not broken. You're just unfinished. So if something stirred in you today, don't ignore it. Don't numb it. Move with it. And I want to once again invite you to join Disrupting Survival Mode, the Facebook community where healing is loud and messy and real. I also want to invite you to buy my book, The Survival Mode Exit Plan, because your breakthrough deserves a blueprint. And if you felt seen today, be sure to share this episode with someone who needs to hear it, subscribe, and drop a review. That's how we amplify the voices that need to be heard. And remember, this isn't about fixing yourself. This is about finding yourself again beneath the rubble. Until next time, choose ease, choose power, choose you. This is Survival Mode Disrupted. Let's keep shaking shit up.